answers, yes. Now's a chance to ask questions of everybody. If there's anything... The air conditioning goes off if the doors are open, that's the problem.
Hooray!
Heating.
Can you guys at the back open the windows? Because the air conditioner isn't doing anything.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
let's see if that works.
Well done, yes, it's with the draft.
So, there have been so many different interesting things that have come up today.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
First of all, I wanted to say to Stephen a massive, well, thank you to everyone, but Stephen, your speech was really, really fascinating. It might be my ignorance here, but in the story you told about the gentleman with going through the extremes of his behaviour from the good boy to this wild man, it sounded like he had to, would you say he had to go through that process in order to get where he was?
Is there any chance you could answer that? And,
I was going to say, did he have to get to that through the process of the two extremes in order to come back to the centre, like we said? And if so, what exactly was the role of the therapist, of yourself, with that man during that time?
Well, firstly, an apology, because I wasn't watching the time, and Ruth very kindly looked at me to say, you need me on the time, so I rushed it. That's my responsibility. I think what I was if I'd had time to say more, which I shouldn't be greedy with the time, my sense of him was he was so entrenched with his mother's injunction, you must be a good boy, that's what he was doing in his work life. In fact, he was having no human contact at all. He was going to work, earning big money, getting big deals, and being a really good boy. And for me, I felt that the journey in Antiodromia was he went right to the other side and was a bad boy, which of course was quite unbearable for him in real human terms, to come and sit with me and say things like, the prostitute came to my home last night, she was from a middle European country, and I knocked her down on the price and she begged me for more money. He had to tell me that, so it was quite shaming and humiliating. So he'd gone from this very good boy to a very bad boy, and I think my role in that was to really be with him and, as much as I could, be empathic, but equally to be accepting and trusting that bad boy might lead him in another direction by actually facing himself and finding the middle ground. So that's how I try to position myself in human terms, sitting with him.
So it's actually very humanistic. Sorry, very human. In a sense, what you were giving him was this humanistic holding, like using Rogers' core condition in that sense. So
Rogers' core conditions, Gestalt's dialogical approach, and also while you know, I think John's right. If Jung had been addressed as a humanist, he might balk. But actually, when I moved from my integrative training and went to the Centre for Psychoanalytic Studies, I just eased in, because my sense of his writings and his concepts and his ideas about practice, he's hugely compassionate and humane. So I have no problem moving into the Jungian world because of that fact. I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I really just wanted to pick up where the last session ended with Dale, I think really joining Chris with you, talking about feeling comfortable with not knowing. And my immediate reaction was, well, bully for you. I usually feel bloody uncomfortable not knowing. Sometimes it's okay. But usually, when we're really in a position of not knowing, we can't think, we feel paralysed, we feel the demand of our patients to help them. What the hell are you doing? You know, you're meant to be helping me, wanting to understand. And I'm thinking, great, please, please, Dale, give me the technique for feeling comfortable in that situation.
Marty, we'll be delighted to do that. I think that the technique is called mindfulness. As a meditator for quite a long number of years, the space that I go into when I'm into not knowing is exactly the same as the uncomfortable space of meditation. When you sit down to have a good sit, and all that happens is your mind is flooded with rage, anger, hatred, hostility, the wish to trample all over anything and everyone. So that staying with not knowing is certainly isn't comfortable, but there are ways of practicing being with not knowing all by yourself. And usually this is best done in a collective, so that meditation practice is much better done in a meditation group. I'm very lucky that I go to the Buddhist Society, where the Theravada class practice being with not knowing and sitting there raging and filled with fury at least once a week. So that would be my recommendation. The only trouble is that presently mindfulness seems to have been detached from Buddhism, which is a bit like detaching it from the moral basis. After all, it's quite possible to be extraordinarily mindful and be a serial killer, or very mindful and rob banks, or very mindful and be a terrorist. And you've got to be really mindful to blow up the Houses of Parliament. Unfortunately, Guy Fawkes wasn't really mindful enough. That would be my short answer, is it's to do with mindfulness. The second thing it's to do with is to do with the idea of us being an ecosystem. It's not just me that's sitting there holding the unknowing, it's me and my supervisor and all my analytic colleagues and everyone who has ever helped me. And that's one of the reasons I keep this rock on the table, and that's why Viv was so right in what she said earlier about the whole of the consulting room becomes a holding space. So it's not just me that's holding it, it's the pictures I've got on the wall, it's the atmosphere that's in the space, it's those things that I relax into when the patients are driving me mental. I'm not going to say I'm very good at being with not knowing, but it's that trick of trying to be just a little bit more comfortable with it than the patient is, which sometimes works.
Okay, I think that answered it, because it probably says something about what I actually managed to do, one way or another, in some of those ways. I think it was feeling comfortable with it that made me wonder. I can do it, but it doesn't mean I feel very comfortable with it, even if it's okay.
I'm only ever comfortable with it on a Friday. That's the day I don't work.
I'd just like to say something about that, because this idea of not knowing is becoming more and more popular at the moment. In fact, last year I marked a thesis of somebody on negative capability, which is another way of saying it. And what I'd like to say about it is that the ability to go into a place of not knowing and wait is essentially a subtle level concept. It's a subtle level ability. And if you're at any other level of consciousness, it's very hard to do. It doesn't come naturally. But if you are in the subtle level, it's actually very easy to do. And it comes very naturally. And it's very much to do with intuition. And intuition works exactly like that. You go into a place of not knowing and wait.
I just wanted to add to this a little bit, because I see it slightly differently. I'm a bit uncomfortable with the juxtaposition that seems to be developing in the room between knowing and not knowing, because I think both have their place, and actually we need them both. And that place that was described, that Martin, that you asked about not knowing, is, I think, also the place that I'm calling being, embodied being. And I personally feel it is possible to be in both places at once. You know, that I can be in a being space, but it also allows me to sing and relate. And I kind of adjust a little bit this way, adjust a little bit that way. It's all fluid. But I'm very uncomfortable with this juxtaposition between thinking and being, because I think we're both. And I think I feel that the rejection of the language that was mentioned a little bit earlier kind of implies, when we use this medical language, all we are doing is pathologizing, and I don't think that's it has a place. But my point earlier was there's a dimension to this that we need to reflect a little bit more. So we need to know the kind of things that we're inviting when we use that particular language. We invite things. We invite, I feel we invite almost visceral things in the therapist, visceral images. And I think it helps us to be aware of that. And my term, clinical paradigm, tries to frame that. So or a pre-clinical prejudice tries to frame that so that we can talk about this dimension. And then, you know, we can all choose.
I just want to thank you so much for your clarity on that point. It's brilliant. Thank you.
There's also something there about beyond without memory or desire.
Yes.
Which I think is important.
Yeah.
Yes.
You want to? Yeah. Okay. Can I go to him?
Yes, of course.
Therapeutics, as you were saying, pretty much well.
Can't hear.
Sorry. Therapeutics has just said pretty much what I was going to say, albeit in a slightly different way. I predict that within the next year or two, there will be a conference criticising the notion of not knowing. Whenever something becomes a cliche in therapy, like for example relational, at some point we start to realise, and I'm going to use the P word, it hasn't been used yet today, postmodern. And there is a wonderful book by Christopher Haug called Jung and the Postmodern, excellent book, that actually, as soon as something gets taken for granted, there's always a shadow side, something is being denied, and we need to really open it up to critical. Someone did use the word deconstruction of areas, so we're close to Derrida, which is a good start. But I just think that that this kind of not knowing notion, we just need to start to think about it a bit more subtly and in a more kind of complex way, because it is becoming a cliche very rapidly.
I'd like to respond to that, because I think maybe if I had to have a label, maybe it's pre-modern, in that I'm wanting to rely much more on story and implicit knowledge and implicit skills that are informed, rather than from an abstract conceptual framework that somehow support the process as it unfolds. That's not that the process won't unfold anyway, but that there might be some catalysts that can support that. And I think this is a very different sort of knowledge than the knowledge about. And the suggestion from us, I think, is that sometimes the knowledge about gets in the way of being sensitive to the phenomenon and the experience.
Can I just add to that? I agree very much, but I think there's a further conceptual, but also visceral step that we can take, and that takes us into transmodern, post-postmodern or transmodern. And that means we take along what you've said, we take that, we embrace what you've said, but we go a further step, so that we don't juxtapose between so much between thinking and being. It's not a juxtaposition. We can do both, or we can be both, and we can calibrate between, and we don't have to have that opposition, and then we come into trance.
That's exactly what the pre-modern is, when they weren't juxtaposed and differentiated.
No. What I mean, the point is that I'm making is, when you go one step further, it becomes both. The capacity to differentiate and the capacity to embrace everything. So embracing includes.
Birgitte. Just one moment. Helen, and then Anne Young, and then you.
Birgitte, would you say that what I was talking about this morning about Lynn Jacobs encapsulated the Gestaltist, she encapsulated Buber's ideas in I thou interpenetrated with I it, so that put very simply, but it seems to me to be capturing something of what you're getting at. That, you know, you're in the I-thou knowing nothing uncertain, but then you're in the I-it, and actually we know quite a bit, I think, hopefully we do, so that you interpenetrate it, and it's not either-or,
and we can do stroke be both, and almost at the same time.
I'm
just wondering if you want to follow on, because I'd like to change the subject. Yes, if I may.
Can you hear me? Yes. And just to follow on Chris's point about pre-story, I was at a conference in Ireland in August called The Emotional Life in Ireland, and I think they used a very useful term, which is vernacular psychotherapy, which simply means using story as a tool. I think that's a bit general, isn't it?
Anne Young next.
Thank you. Dale, you touched on our nation's obsession with growth. You just mentioned it, I think, right at the beginning of your talk. Or somebody did. Chris, sorry. I was wondering how, if you had any thoughts about how that might impinge on the sort of nature of the work we do. After all, it's out there, and that then involves the rape of the earth, and et cetera, et cetera. It's sort of connected for me with our work, but I haven't developed the thinking, so I wanted to do that.
Well, it's probably a very big topic, but maybe briefly, it's to do with focus on the individual. Yes, if the individual is not part of a community, then they, out of their alienated state, they feel they have to do something, they have to grow. Whereas maybe actually it's the fall. Maybe they have to fall, or if they have to grow at all, they have to grow down. And that growing down is a very familiar concept of revision. I hope it's suitably confusing. You look confused.
Well, the message I get from government is that economic growth is the sort of panacea to all our problems. You know, we have to have endless
Well, from an eco-psychology viewpoint, it's the basis of all our problems.
Yes.
And it's such a pity that psychotherapists might still use the word growth, is buying into the same paradigm.
Thank you. That's
good.
Thank you. Paul.
Yeah, I agree with the idea of not knowing. Developed quite a severe trauma about 3 or 4 months ago, and it came exactly from that. I didn't know. I was making plans which I thought were going to come true. I realised I was living in the future, not in the moment, and not knowing would have been the better way to do it. I was making so many assumptions that I started reading and not told about the Tower of Now. And what I'd like to do is actually relate it to what we're doing right now. So I may have missed something, but we don't seem to be doing that. But there's 100 people, and we can't all contribute to this conference. So how is it that some people do and some people don't, but we're not even related to that, as far as I can see. And the other thing is, I've virtually nobody here, So that's another way of not knowing. That's how to know people do. But how do you get to know them? That's it. The other point I'd like to make. Okay.
Yeah. This may fall completely flat, but this is the plenary, and yes, we're halfway through the plenary, and I want to say something about the relations between humanistic psychotherapy and Jungian analysis. What the Tavistock people who mock would say, getting a little bit back on task. You mentioned I must have some reasons for doing the conference, for suggesting it and for fighting for this conference for 12 years against resistance from both traditions. Quite intense, quite vitriolic resistance. Both traditions, humanistic and Jungian, had a beef, had a conflict with psychoanalysis. Jung's conflict with psychoanalysis is well known, and John, in Ordinary Ecstasy, wrote about humanistic psychotherapy as the third force against behaviorism and against psychoanalysis. Do we have anything in common? I think we do. I don't agree we've been doing nothing. We have been proving that people from both traditions can talk to one another, albeit with difficulty, because there hasn't been a public conversation of this kind before. John and I searched our memories, and there hasn't been a Jungian humanistic conference in Britain, and I don't know of one anywhere, what the conclusion we've reached. There are some very obvious things that these two traditions have in common. Respectful attitude to spirituality. The mobilization for therapy of human creativity. The personal presence and authentic presence of the therapist. And a deep respect for the wisdom of the client that she brings to the room long before she meets the therapist. These we have in common. But we're also, I think, facing the same cultural crisis, each tradition. There's a battle for the soul going on in Western countries, especially in Britain, and that means what kind of psychotherapy is valued, what kind of psychotherapy is respected and above all paid for by our state. Yes. And I think that what I had in mind in part about this event was some kind of alliance. Now, ideally, it should be a tripartite alliance between humanistic psychotherapy, Jungian analysis, and psychoanalysis. But for the moment, psychoanalysis would have a problem with that. Unfortunately, I don't think it will always, because they're feeling the cosh too. In many ways, they're feeling it worse because they had the best position in the public sector of all the traditions, and now they're no better off than anybody else. But they're not here, in spite of the odd reference to Bion, and that's okay for the moment. What I wanted was some kind of a grassroots alliance between the humanistic troops and the Jungian troops to fight for both the traditional values of depth work and for some new things too, some of which you guys have been talking about in relation to getting beyond the individual, beyond the closeted consulting room, and seeing that the therapy is about a great many wider things. Now, I don't know whether a meeting like this is going to produce an alliance. It's not going to produce a document. It's probably not going to produce a committee. It might produce some individual contacts. But actually, those are not the things that make for change. In the end, what makes for change is a groundswell of opinion. And what I detect out there in the therapy world, and it is also in the rank and file of the psychoanalytic world, even if it's not in their leadership, who disdain the Jungians and who disdain the humanistics, there is a great desire amongst the therapy folk of this country that something be done, and soon, before our work, our world, yes, our livelihoods as well, is completely smashed. And that is why, on one level, there are other reasons, especially for me, the historical connections between the two traditions. That's one very important reason why I fought for this for so long. It's not about the in here for me, it's about the out there.
Thank you, absolutely. I can see you're waving at the right in the back. Come here.
I'm an integrative.
Could you stand up? It might help to hear.
I'm an integrative counsellor.
Right here.
I'm an integrative. Did you hear that?
Yes.
So, I actually don't recognise this division that you're talking about. Yes. I guess that's why I was trained in integrative counselling. And we were trained in many different, including Indian and
still very difficult to hear you.
I don't do this standing up with people very well. I've been sitting here wanting to say something. I've a bit about the collective thing as well, get out there. But I don't recognise this big division that you're talking about, I'm afraid. I don't get it. Sorry. I don't get it.
Paul.
Yep. Sorry. Similarly, I mean, I'm just completing my training as an integrative and transpersonal psychotherapist, and maybe I'm still stuck in that fervor stage, but I don't understand this division. I don't understand how they can't flow and work with each other. I don't understand why we can't think with our hearts, and how structure doesn't also involve process. Is there not, within a developmental structure, is there not an individuation process going on between each of those developmental levels? Can we not have both? Are they not inherently part of each other? I do not understand the separation here.
Can you give it to?
On an individual level, yes, this awareness exists, but out there, politically and socially, there is this division, as there is division in many other aspects. And I think if we are not politically aware of what happens out there and we stay with how we feel as therapists, we can integrate parts, then we are going to lose the game. And I'm aware of losing this game as one of the new members of this profession, but I don't want to lose the game. I want to be out there and be active and be as everyone else. So it's the political awareness of the division that needs to be more prominent.
Can I just comment on that? There's a lovely word that we haven't used. It's money. Okay? Why is there a difference? It's to do with money. Why did I train as a psychosynthesis therapist first? Because as a very poor medical student, I could afford to do it. I could not afford 150 quid a week, which is what I was being asked for 4 times a week analysis. So I trained as a humanistic psychotherapist first, but I'm extraordinarily glad that I did, because I would not have had the robustness necessary to go through the analytic process. So there's a finance barrier here, and it's extraordinarily real and very hurtful. It also means that people from the class that I come from, which is the working class, hardly ever get their foot through the door, and most black people don't get their foot through the door either. I've been delighted in the last 3-4 years to have half of my black practice from ethnic minority backgrounds. But that's costly, because they can't afford the same fees as everybody else. So it's all very well for us to go on about it, but we can't all do this, make things different just by Robin Hooding. When I was a kid as a young analyst at St George's, we had a huge psychotherapy department with 15 or 20 people in it. We had family therapy, group therapy, art therapy, you name it, therapy. Now there are 3 people doing CBT. This is not progress. Where is the trade union of analysts, psychotherapists, that has said anything about it? It isn't there, because we've all been too busy fighting silly little turf wars. This has got to stop, hasn't it? It's really got to stop.
But we're not all doing that.
thank goodness not all of us.
Some of us have just organised a free psychotherapy network for people who have got some space to offer free or very low fee psychotherapy. So I think if more people could just feel a little more imaginative about what's possible, and we could actually alter the culture together as far as things like social class and so on. So.
Well, I was just thinking the same thing. It's something to do with elitism, isn't it? And the Jungians, some of the Jungians in the past have wanted to suit with the Freudians, and they thought they were the best. And actually, we really need to all get onto the same level like we are here, don't we?
John?
First of all, it's so nice to be here. I've come down from North Yorkshire. I mean, I'm doing other things this weekend, but it's a good reason to get down here. In terms of being held and being part of the collective, it's like being back in the 60s and 70s when I was very much part of the counterculture and revolutionary socialists, etc. And it's very good to hear Dale particularly mention the word politics and those two other people who've been talking about the political. Because in terms of the collectiveness that we have further north or where I come from, the start, there's very little feeling that this is quite voting central. My guess is that at least half of the people here are probably from the south and the southeast. And I was just wondering whether, thank you very much, it's taken 14 years to get this going. I think that's absolutely fantastic. I'm afraid that it should take so long for it to happen, basically. And what I was going to ask is whether it be possible, do you ever have conferences further north? I mean, I work sometimes in Hull in the NHS where we do see clients for nothing, and they were quite right. Most of my clients are people who can afford to pay. The people who really need it are the people who are kind of from city states and don't even know what the word psychotherapy is. And they are all people who do need it. So I'm very much, if there's some kind of network going whereby.
Do you know what? This organisation, CAP, we've never done anything up north, I'm afraid to say. But what a great idea.
Yeah. Good to hear somebody. You can tell I'm a southerner by birth, but I've been living in Lancashire for about 15 years. And what is? I guess I want to say something about the humanistic tradition and the Jungian that I've experienced since living in another part of the country, because in the part of the country that I live, which is sort of west of Lancaster, that bit, there's a strong tradition of person-centred counselling, and also other manifestations of humanistic gestalt and transpersonal dimensions. So, for example, where I'm based, the uni I'm based at, I've been doing some work with William Western, Manchester University, who some people will probably know his work in the room here, I should think. And what's been really good is I've been just doing some project work with him around spirituality in the therapy room, and we've been doing some bridging really between the humanistic, transpersonal and the Jungian, and it's sparked a lot of interest within the communities, the academic and therapeutic stuff. So there's that side of it. I think there's so much potential for work together in that sense. But also on the political and social side, I think I'm very much with the last speaker that all over the country, not getting carried away perhaps, but across the country, I think there are pockets of people who are very interested in these ideas, and there's a lot of potential to work on that in both a kind of theoretical stroke therapeutic sense, but also in terms of what the implications are in terms of the profession, in terms of the social political routes that we might want to take all of this thinking. So a sense to me of a latent potential, and again I'm not being too rose-tinted about it, but it kind of is there, and so it's great to see this dialogue happening here today.
Thank you, Phil. Gentleman at the back.
I wanted to pick up on my comments about what Andrew said about the idea that this profession and the people it looks after might be being reduced by sort of spending and other issues, and suggest that the space of human experience that everybody has been speaking about isn't just about healing and just about being a part of a health system, but it's being that sense of a wider sense of humanity, of connectedness, of respect for the individual and who that individual really is. And I know growth has been a bit of a strange word, but yeah, let's use the word in its humanistic sense, is under threat in a wider sense of the community than just in health. And that if we, as the practitioners who look after that space, or maybe that's I'm going off a different direction, but are feeling under threat in society, maybe that's because of a much wider space where that is being squashed and is needed. So I wonder whether the political aspect of it is not just about health, but about much more general culture, much more general policy, much more general a broadening of the narrow economic focus into something much wider and more human than in a very wide sense, and not just in the immediate sort of medical field, if you like. That was my commenting.
I knew you wanted to speak.
I just wanted to raise an interesting question, interesting to me. Quite a few people today have said that they are integral. And this word integral bothers me a bit, because what I've discovered is that when people say the word integral, they very often do not include the transpersonal. And to me, if you're going to be integral, you must include the transpersonal. It seems obvious. Otherwise, you're not really being integral. So I just thought I'd put that out. A bit of puzzlement on my part.
Someone here, Ruth, has got a mind.
Yes.
Are you keeping order?
No, go on.
I wonder, as a group, could we seek to educate the collective or the general public in the value of therapy as opposed to the quick fixes of CBT or the drugs industry, because that's who we're competing against, and we're competing against the medical profession. But it's much, much easier to hand out drugs if you have people coming every week with their anxiety problems, with their depression problems. And that's politically where we've got to start and compete against the drug industry and the quick fixes if we're going to be here.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would disagree with you there.
Could I say again that quite a few of us are doing this now, so you could talk to people who are doing it and we could get together.
Yep.
My question is to come in on that.
I can't hear you.
Is that better?
Yeah.
No? Oh. Okay.
Yes, that's good.
Oh,
yes.
God. All right. So, actually, it's to say something to Dale. Were you just dissing neuroscience a minute ago when you were doing your... A little bit? Because I went to a lecture a couple weeks ago by Alan Shaw. Dull, I have to admit. But he did... Had 2 days before, had presented the entire lecture again to the House of Parliament. And people were listening because they've got science that backs it up. So I know we know this, all the stuff that they're giving us, because we've been practicing it for years, and they're just proving what we intuitively feel. But if we try and segregate ourselves from them again, then we're going to have to fight another battle. Whereas if we could piggyback somehow, if they've already got a gateway into Parliament, and say, look, you're proving that CBT isn't really the way, you're proving that attachment is the way and therapy works. But is there a way that we can do something with that rather than just sit here by ourselves?
Anybody who can talk to politicians and get them to listen is obviously doing a wonderful job. Whether they actually are interested in the economics that would then follow from that, which would be to reconstruct the psychotherapy service in this country, which they have demolished, would be wonderful. My point about neuroscience isn't that I think it's a bad thing. I enjoy reading Alan Shaw, I've heard him lecture. I enjoy reading all the other guys. I love these fascinating stories. But to me, it really is not more than talking about a particular kind of mythology. It's a very popular mythology, because if we stick the word science onto something, it's very, very, how should we say, sexy, isn't it? Very sexy. And we can use all these different sexy things to get in the way of being with a person. And healing animals can do this as well, because we can get what Andrew called mandalized. You know, we get obsessed with mandalas, or we get obsessed with archetypes, or we get obsessed with little myths. So what I'm really trying to say is, it's quite good to notice what particular narrative or discourse we get obsessed with, whether it's a neuroscientific one, or a developmental one, or a Jungian one. It's, and that doesn't help.
I'd like to sort of move sideways back to the question about the society and the culture we're in. Seems very important to me that we start shifting our frame from the individual to understanding the individual in the context of our culture. And in my view, we live in an escapist culture. So to offer the pleasure of psychotherapy, which means facing into your pain, it's not something that fits very well in our culture. It's a countercultural condition. And that seems very important that we do something about that. And maybe we need allies outside the psychotherapy profession, from anthropology, from social work. I think there's a lot of resistance to what's happening in our culture at the moment, that maybe we need to make allies there as well as between ourselves.
Can I just check with the other members of the panel if there's a last sentence you'd like to... If there's anything that we've missed out, or I've rushed you on from, or... Yes, John?
What I missed out about the central level, which I think is important enough to underline, there's a logic in the central level which is different from any of the other levels. And the logic is this: you cannot ask the question, is it true, at the subtle level. It's not the right question. You have to ask instead the question, and what effect did that have on you? So somebody said, I saw an angel, or a fairy spoke to me, or I was abducted by aliens, or whatever it is, some subtle level phenomenon. You don't ask, have you got tape recordings? Did you take a video? Were there witnesses? When did it happen exactly? And so. You ask the question, and what effect did that have on you? It's the same with past lives and these kind of things. What effect did that have on you? I'm sorry, I just forgot to say that. That I could just
shove it in.
Okay. Fergus, go on.
I would just like to emphasize as well, next to all the political things, external political things that are needed, that we'll just talk about, sometimes we may forget that, I'm exaggerating here, but half the country is in psychotherapy with us. There are so many more people than, you know, in public life and so on, are in psychotherapy, and we have an effect there as well. And so, not means hope or spirit. Just remember that bit.
Yes.
That's what I want to talk
about. Perhaps that's a good moment to draw this bit to a close. Before we give a hand for our panel, I just want to say that we've got a very quick tea break here, and perhaps you could bring your drinks back in, because then we'll have plenty of time for the film. Okay, thank you.
Paul Atkinson. Yeah.
Did you do all this?
this kind of stuff as well. You do all this kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, I'm a union parent.
It's turning off.
I've switched it off.
Oh,
I've just switched it off. I'm going to switch it off. Yeah, but I'm mainly very political. Very political. I'm involved in Tower Hamlets. Doing the mental health side, which is
I should be young. Okay,
we started the free psychotherapy network.
Is that happening? The Association of Psychotherapy.
Yeah, I do know them. No, they're kind of stuff. Well, they might do some no cost. But our website is a statement about neoliberalism.
What's it called?
The Free Psychotherapy Network, all one word. No, the just free psychotherapy network.com. And we've got 15 therapists signed up. And actually, what we're seeing a lot of occupied activists because they've got no money. They're very bright. They want their connections with therapists and their own staff, but also to be able to bring the personal psychological.
It's really good to know. It's really good to know because it's so good. You know, I know for my son, his mates were very involved in all that kind of activist stuff. It's very hard for them to get any kind of support for their own needs because they're so busy actually being politically doing that. They can't actually get any support
for their own needs.
Yes, they do. And they can't do the activism.
Went down to occupy at St. Paul's. A group of us went down there.
Chris went.
Yeah, that's where I met Chris. We met down there. Yeah, so that's been great for me because it's reconnecting me with the late 60s. I was in the red therapy group that John was talking about, and in the men's group that produced McKenzie on Big Flame, which was personal. I did a lot of therapy. I'm now doing men's therapy groups like we did then. When we did then, it's fantastic. As soon as you get a group of folks in the room, their agenda is about their emotional, just talking about what's going on.
It's very, very, very interesting.